Hello, this is David Gawk, Head of Public Policy at McFarlane's, and welcome to the latest in our Policy in Practice podcasts. Today we are going to be discussing central bank digital currencies, not so much Bitcoin, but Gritcoin, the new craze, if you like, area where central banks around the world, including the Bank of England, are exploring what CBDCs may do. And I'm delighted to be joined by two of my McFarlane's colleagues, Safine Moran, who is a senior member of our law tech team, or tech guru, as we like to think of him, and Gavin Horan from our financial services team, our financial services policy guru. So we've got two gurus, and we're going to take an opportunity to have a look at CBDCs and what they're all about, and various arguments. Relating to that, of course, many public policy issues related to that topic. So let's start off at Saf. Do you want to tell us what is Gritcoin?
Sure. So I'll start with introducing the concept of central bank digital currencies to begin with. A central bank digital currency is essentially a currency owned by a central bank, such as the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, or the US Federal Reserve, that digitizes the native currency. So in this case, if we're talking about Bitcoin or the digital pound, it would represent the digital pound as a token in the same use of the technology used by Bitcoin, which is a blockchain-based ledger system. Now, in this case, the idea is that it is fully centralized. So the Bank of England would own the digital pound, would own the ledger containing every record of each digital pound, and it's aimed to create a secure, efficient, and low-cost payment system. Broadly, and again, just to highlight some of the differences here, most money in the world is created by banks and is typically created in the form of a bank deposit. This would change that. So instead of selling bank deposits through a clearinghouse or through a clearing system, you would have the central bank own that payment system in the form of a centralized ledger. So every single record of every cash payment is tracked on a record by record basis. So think, you know, lines of data in a spreadsheet, and each would trace each pound to each line of that data, which is what the Bank of England is trying to do with Bitcoin.
Very good. And what in terms of where we are, where's the Bank of England?
Yes, I think if I could just add to that definition first of all, because I think that's really helpful, because it sort of explains practically, you know, fundamentally what is it. I think we'll come on to Bitcoin in a moment, but if we think about what CBDCs really are, I mean, there's sort of three components to it. It's a digital form of money, fiat money, in other words, it's legal tender. And I think that's really important from the Bank of England's perspective. It sees it primarily as a means of efficient payments by consumers, real retail consumers. And the third part is it's issued by a central bank. Now, if you look at those three things, two of them are already things that we're familiar with. We're familiar with digital money. Most importantly, people will be familiar with the newer forms, crypto, for instance. I think it's important to point out this is not crypto, although it's very often framed in the same sense. And that's because the second part, crypto, generally speaking, is not legal tender. Now, it is in El Salvador, for instance, but generally speaking, it's not legal tender because of its volatility, because it's not pegged to an underlying asset, such as a currency, in this circumstance. So to your point, David, whereas the Bank of England, it's talking about a digital form of money, which is tied to the pound. The third bit is the new bit. It's issued by a central bank. Now, the digital money that we're all familiar with, as Saf said, you know, the majority of it is currently issued by private banks. It's about 95% of the money in circulation in the UK is issued by, you know, your high street banks predominantly, but by private banks. Now, what's happening here is that we're moving away from a system where you'd have the majority of the money issued by private banks issued by the central bank. And at the moment, that's only about 5% of money, and it takes the sort of real form of cash predominantly. What the Bank of England is intending to do is to flip that to a digital form of the money. Now, I think you can sort of suggest, although it's only one new element of those three things, what the Bank of England is proposing is really significant, because you're moving away from a system whereby money creation is disaggregated, diversified through the economy, and it happens pretty much on a free market basis, if you want to describe it broadly as that. What we're talking about is moving to a system where money creation is sort of centrally planned. And that's a really profound change. And I think, you know, as we talk through the details of this, I think what we're going to suggest is what will the effects be is very much dependent on the policy choices and the design which is really important. We'll come on to what the Bank of England is suggesting. But back to your original question, David, about 190 central banks are looking or have projects or have digital currencies in some places already issued. And what the Bank of England are doing is looking at their own version of that. I think they'll touch on, you know, those 190 central banks are all having slightly different policy aims and slightly different design features, which end up with really drastically different consequences in terms of, you know, what does the CBDC actually do to markets and consumers.
I suppose the big differential, if we're comparing it to kind of crypto, is quite the reverse in terms of this is centralized rather than decentralized. And we'll talk about the privacy concerns also in a moment, and there's plenty of those. Saf, do you want to say a little bit more about the technology in a way that some of us will understand about how it actually practically would work?
I think for the benefit of this conversation, I'm not going to get too deeply into the weeds of precisely how blockchain technology works.
That could be one for a follow-up podcast.
Sure.
For those demanding the weeds.
But for these purposes, there are typically two key aspects to all blockchain-based or token-based crypto assets. First is that they are typically decentralized. So instead of having some kind of central authority manage that ledger, generally speaking, normal crypto assets distribute their authority across multiple nodes or multiple instances of people or computers or authority controlling those nodes. And the idea is that everyone has access to the same information at the same time. It's multiple distributed ledgers. The second is the idea of immutability. Every new entry on that ledger or new digital pound or new Bitcoin or Britcoin or whatever we're calling them effectively sits on a new entry, which records all of that information against some element of cryptography, so a code. And it's that code that makes that ledger linked to the owner of it while still giving that owner anonymity, which is the key thing here. Now, the immutability elements of what the Bank of England is trying to do effectively stays as part of their structure and as part of their design, but it's the decentralizing element that falls away. The Bank of England is quite keen to make sure that that ledger is controlled by them and by them specifically. And we'll get into the reasons why, and we'll get into the reasons, I think, what's prompted this particular move. Obviously, not just by the Bank of England, but by other central banks. But broadly, the aim seems to be to say that there is an obvious monopoly in the idea of a payment system. And rather than allow a tech company such as Facebook or allow any other market for monopolization to occur, the Bank of England is stepping in and saying, no, we are the natural monopoly for a payment system. Touching a little bit on what Gavin said, it is very interesting because it drastically changes the nature and the relationship between central and private banks, because instead of access to money effectively being distributed through private banks and intermediaries, they are effectively communicating to the Bank of England as part of their design process through what the Bank of England is calling an API layer. I'm not going to get too deep into the weeds here on the tech specifics of this, but API stands for Application Programming Interface. It's a normal phrase we use in the context of programming to describe the way that applications talk and share information with each other. We use it all the time in the context of our own work. What the Bank of England seems to be suggesting is a version of that to denominate the relationship between their ledger and what the private banks have access to, and what the private banks can then pass on to their intermediaries and the end user, which is us accessing our wallets and our coins. So there's quite a bit going on. And the truth is, while I've touched a little bit on some of the technology involved there, I purposefully haven't gone too deep into precisely how that's going to work, because the Bank of England doesn't quite know that yet. They're very much still in a design phase right now. There have been two consultation papers released recently. The first is the digital pound, a new form of money for household and businesses, And the second is the technology working paper, which was submitted a bit more recently. But the Bank of England is still very much in the design phase, and it's still pending a decision to proceed with the build at all. if it does get built, we're looking at around the middle of the decade before we start to see what their build process is going to be, what the digital pound is actually going to work in this case. And the actual introduction for the user is going to be the second half of the decade. We are still talking about a major national infrastructure project requiring significant investment proceeding to build. And we'll get into this, and we'll get into some of the, I think, the more interesting public policy elements of this, would require extensive evidence and public engagement, which the Bank of England has only really started doing.
Gavin?
If I could just pick up some really interesting points there, but in terms of the relationship between the central bank and the private banks, because I think, you know, Saf rightly says there's a lot of the design elements which are still TBC, and the Bank of England's obviously working through this process that Saf described. But broadly speaking, the way central banks are approaching this question is whether they should be issuing a wholesale CBD or a retail CBDC. And the Bank of England is very much focusing on the retail side, but there are some nuances around that. So I think it's probably helpful because it comes down to that relationship between the central bank and private banks, if we just sort of describe the distinction between them. So the wholesale side is a situation whereby the central bank would be issuing this currency, the CBDC, to the private bank. So the relationship there for issuance is between those two entities, not the consumer. And that we've already got a system a little bit like that, to the extent that private banks hold deposits at the central bank, i.e. reserves. And when payments happen between those private banks, they're sort of settled through the central bank. Now, the Bank of England isn't focusing on that when it describes a digital pound. However, it is undertaking a separate project around the UK's real-time settlement system, which is trying to improve that and improve the efficiency. So that's kind of a separate element that's happening. And they're probably, you know, although there's perhaps some benefits in payment efficiency, it's not the sort of game-changing thing that we're talking about at the outset of this conversation. That is more, I think, in two elements. For wholesale CBDC, cross-border payments is a big thing, and we've seen projects in different parts of the world. So Hong Kong and Singapore, for instance, you can imagine the big trading nations are working together on this. The ECB in Japan, because again, you've got a lot of cross-currency trade happening there. But where the Bank of England is differentiating itself, and there are other central banks looking at this question, is the retail CBD side. In other words, the central bank issues the currency directly to consumers, which they can therefore use for payments. And that's the really game-changing bit. Now, where the Bank of England is sort of slightly different to others is it's proposing a sort of hybrid system. So it has sort of wholesale elements, but it's a retail CBDC. Central bank would issue the currency to the private banks, and the private banks essentially act like intermediaries and pass that currency on to the retail consumer, i.e. to you and me. So you've got, I think it's worth just saying that at the outset, that if this is a retail system, but it's got some kind of strange nuances whereby the banks, and I think Saf alluded to this, the private banks effectively become sort of the front arm and the outpost of the central bank in the kind of integrated system. So it really changes the dynamic in terms of how a currency is issued and used.
I was going to ask about the private banks, about how, you know, how fundamental a threat is this to the kind of business model of our banks. I mean, if this really takes off, you know, what do they currently do that they're not going to be, you know, actually they're made redundant?
Well, this is a big issue, and the Bank of England addressed it. Bank disintermediation is essentially the concept. And, you know, as the name sort of implies, it means bypassing the typical powers that a bank would have, a private bank would have. Now, I suppose it's really helpful if we describe what is that power. Essentially, and this is not the way most of us think about it, but money is created by the private banks. What they do is, you know, I rock up to a bank and say, excuse me, can I have a loan? They look me up and down and go, yeah, okay, maybe we will. You then get some money deposited in your account, a loan given to you, and it comes into the bank account as a deposit. So that money's come out of thin air. Now, the bank obviously has to keep some reserves against that, but you've got new money created. What this process would do by disintermediating them is it wouldn't be the private bank that creates that money, or at least not for the CBDC. It would be the central bank that makes that ultimate that decision, and the private bank passes it on, whether that's in the form of a loan, or because this is CBDC is envisioned to be fungible, I could turn up with some cash and say I want to switch this for CBDC, and the bank would therefore act as the intermediary to do that. What it does, I mean, it has potentially quite a lot of really significant effects. I think the first one is that banks have to find new sources of funding. So you've got the central bank issuing a risk-free asset you as a consumer decide, well, I don't really need a bank deposit. I can actually just get CBDC instead, because it's, you know, there's no risk of default there. It's issued by the central bank. So that means when banks create loans, they have to find another way of funding it. And that is the wholesale markets. Now, that is relatively more expensive than a deposit. It has the effect that the bank either has two options. It has the credit ration in some, to some extent, either put the price of loans up, or it has to cut down the quantity of lending it does. That obviously has effects for the real economy. It benefits larger banks slightly because they have better access to wholesale funding for obvious reasons of scale. And smaller banks, unfortunately, would be in a position of perhaps being more consolidated, which is something that's already happening in the market. You know, obviously, we've seen through SVB, Credit Suisse recently. So it sort of perpetuates those trends that we're already seeing in the economy. But the important thing is there that there is an impact potentially on lending to the economy, and that has an impact potentially on growth. Because you don't have that magic function happening that banks currently have, which is to sort of invent money out of the air, which hopefully will fund new economic activity. And that's how you get economic.
So there's potentially an access to finance risk.
An access to finance risk, a financial stability risk as well, because you've got this risk-free asset being issued.
There's any question of a run on a bank.
Exactly,
There's an easy, simple answer, and therefore savers could be more volatile. In that sense.
That's right.
True. The other economic restriction, though, is that it does drastically change what private banks are able to do from a broad innovation perspective. If the central bank comes in, and, you know, these are, generally speaking, like the Bank of England is a long-lived organization, it tends to be wary of new developments and payment mechanisms that they don't typically control. I would say, you know, that does seem to be an impetus behind a lot of these moves. The Bank of England saying, we don't really know what this is about, but we don't want anything to develop where we can't set the explicit rules governing them. What that means is that limits the ability of private banks to create their own innovative products. You know, it's been long mooted, for example, that certain private banks or certain institutions, you know, such as the ones we typically associate with the broad crypto market, such as Coinbase, even Facebook, and their initial examinations at the Libra coin. So, for example, them wanting to issue their own cryptocurrency. What we've actually seen here is the bank come in and, you know, lean, I would say, relatively heavily on private banks to say, if you want to have any new innovative ideas that relate to crypto assets, you come to Threadneedle Street first, and we will sort of hold the system that governs what you can do and can't do. So, aside from just like a finance perspective, there's a separate perspective here around like restricting the general sort of future-proofing activity that each private bank might do. Or, I do think this goes to somewhat to motivation, restricting the ability of giant tech monopolies to enter into a market that the Bank of England would prefer to occupy when it comes to the digital band, and say, no, we're going to set the rules here and we're going to be reactive. Because if this is a natural monopoly around payment systems, we're going to be the ones to control it.
I think, to be fair to the Bank of England, they're suggesting that there could be the risk of fragmentation in digital assets. So you have a lot of financial and economic effort being put into creating digital assets, whereas they're saying if we can design the fundamental, one ring to rule them all, digital asset, then innovation gets pushed to the payment service providers, which they call payment interface providers in the consultation, which is to say, you know, banks can therefore design products, ways of accessing consumers, perhaps the tokens and the way that they're distributed in the economy, but the asset itself just remains the one singular thing that everyone works on. So in a way, I think they are trying to channel innovation and get beyond what they would see as the risk of fragmentation, having lots and lots of digital assets and risk being dispersed there.
Because the argument is it's a natural monopoly and you'll have inefficiency if you've got fragmentation.
It is. It's a sovereign money idea, effectively. And that, they are arguing it should be concentrated in the central bank. Now, obviously, this has implications for monetary policy, which I'm sure we'll come on to, but there is a really interesting political aspect of this. If you have sovereign money as an idea, in other words, the public, the state, should be creating most money that's in supply. Well and good, but obviously that's concentrated in an independent Bank of England at the moment. And there will be, obviously, Bank of England has accrued a lot of power over several crises through extraordinary monetary measures and so on. I think there will be more questions around the accountability of the Bank of England if it does have regulatory, monetary power and the power, obviously, around the creation of new money.
Yes. And now, so how much of this do you think is a sense of, look, if we don't take action, we, the central banks, don't take action, this sort of stuff is going to happen anyway, but it's going to be kind of run out of control and we'll have that fragmentation. And how much of it is a sort of genuinely sort of positive agenda? Saf, you were talking earlier about the reasons for doing this and making the payment system more efficient and so on. Is this a kind of reactive defensive mode, or is this a proactive, you know, positive agenda, or is it a bit of both?
I do think it is both. I touched a little bit on the sort of reactivity of this and why the Bank of England might want to be exploring this and sort of contrasting this with tech giants' ability to sort of step into this monopoly instead. But there is also the broad objective and aim at sort of restoring confidence in monetary systems in general. The Bank of England does have a unique role in anchoring value and promoting confidence in the monetary system, which is exactly a quote from the consultation. And they do genuinely think that mainstreaming this technology in the form of the digital pound could play an important role in expanding retail access to that money. It is interesting, though, because the idea of digital cash, certainly from the Bank of England's perspective, has been around since the early 90s. This is not something that's just completely come out of thin air. It has been something of a considered exercise, because I think there's always been a recognition that cash itself could become something centralized in some kind of digital format. The interesting question for me is, why have they alighted on blockchain and crypto asset based technology to do this? And I think that does go to another potential aim of the Bank of England, which is to take some of this technology, which, you know, putting it somewhat mildly, has been the purview of a particular marketplace of hyper-libertarian maximalists when it comes to Bitcoin and other crypto asset trading, and mainstream it in a way that would be effective, safe, and marketable to the average consumer. And I think that does change the nature of how the Bank of England wants to try and approach this, because aside from the broad public policy objectives, there is also a genuine benefit to the consumer, which is to make this more accessible. There are also specific objectives around privacy and around crime and fraud prevention. Interestingly, I would say that while those are two broadly positive objectives, there are some interesting conflicts between the two. Now, the way that the privacy aspect of this is supposed to work, and it relates to what Gavin was talking about the changed relationship between private banks and central banks, is that your private banks or your intermediaries, or your PIPs or ESIPs as they're named in the consultation, are the ones that the users primarily interact with. So all of your personal data, all of the data relating to your account and your access to your money, is controlled by them because of what I referred to earlier as the API layer between the private banks who issue the digital pound on behalf of the Bank of England. The Bank of England's design proposal is that they do not see any personal data of any Bitcoin user. It's cryptographically generated against a code that is linked to that particular user's wallet in the same way that current crypto assets work. However, and again, this goes a little bit to the crime and fraud prevention angle, Bitcoin can't really be truly anonymous, because as part of that responsibility, they will need to be able to identify and verify users to prevent financial crime. The way that they manage that, or they made it, the way that they may decide to manage that, is still very much something that they're considering as part of the design and build process. Their current suggestion is essentially to have each PIP or each private bank deal with verification separately, rather than have that go back to the core ledger that the bank maintains. But the idea is that the users should be able to choose from a range of wallet services where varying level of identification are accepted. So you might have a wallet service that has a low threshold for identification for a user more interested in privacy, for example. The question is, how does the Bank of England govern that? And I think that's still something that is still in question, because ultimately the wallets and settling will still be controlled directly. And this approach, you know, when we think of blockchain technology, when we think of this technology in general, often one of its mooted benefits is that it is private, it is anonymous. However, it also allows for more fine-grained surveillance and control. If you know what you're doing, you can interrogate a blockchain, including ones that are publicly accessible, like the Bitcoin blockchain. And in fact, you know, criminal prevention authorities have done that in the US and in the UK to trace the source of illicit transactions.
Presumably, you can't have it both ways to argue that this is all going to be completely anonymous and everybody's privacy is going to be protected. And this is going to be a fantastic aid in dealing with money laundering and tax evasion and general criminality. It's sort of, to some extent, one or the other, isn't it?
It's an interesting tension, but it's also something that often comes up when discussing CBDCs in general. The European Central Bank is actually a little bit further along with its public consultation and its survey. And according to at least the results of the current survey, the one mooted request, at least the individuals, institutions tend to front as part of this, is privacy. They want digital cash to work the same way that regular cash does, and that there is no direct identification between, you know, your money and what you spend it on.
I mean, it's already the case. You can, you know, go around this country and find lots of graffiti saying no to CBDCs and things like that. And, you know, there's a sort of libertarian argument, but you don't have to be ultra-libertarian to sort of think, you know, the idea that the entire financial system is essentially in the hands of the state, and if the state so wanted to do so, they could exclude people from buying or selling or doing any kind of economic activity. Is that, I mean, there must be a sort of issue here as to whether you can win public support for a system that is heavily dependent on CBDCs. You know, is there sort of a sense that the public may react against it?
Well, I wonder, Gavin might also touch on this a little bit. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because some of the use cases that were mooted in the consultations touch on aspects of this that interfere a little bit with how we typically understand the Bank of England's role in monetary policy. For example, crisis-era fiscal policy. One of the mooted examples for why CBDCs might be useful is that we would not have needed to go through an extensive legislative process to create the furlough, for example, during the COVID-19 pandemic. If the Bank of England could have just issued, I don't know, 1,000 digital pounds to every single person in the United Kingdom through their wallet, that would have been a more effective way, or certainly a faster way, of solving that sort of crisis era policy. But that is the Bank of England maybe occupying a place legislation will typically have. The other is sanctions policy. If you control access to digital pounds through a centralized ledger that the Bank of England has a record of, you can easily see a situation where anyone on a sanctions list, you know, you can program, we'll come onto that aspect of it a bit later, but you can effectively say, well, you're on a sanctions list, your digital pounds can't be spent here. And we can program that into our ledger for each individual. So it is an interesting thing, because that, again, goes back to the question of sort of fine-grained surveillance. And again, to your point, I don't think you need to be a hyper-libertarian to be concerned about that aspect of those things.
Yeah, and some of the concerns around sanctions are sort of related to real-life events. I mean, the Canadian truckers is a sort of an example that people who often oppose the CBDC will point to, where you had people protest against the government there. That was all around vaccine passports. And their assets were frozen, but that was done through a direction to the private banks. You must not allow these people to access their funds. And obviously the concern is that, you know, whatever people may or may not think of current central banks and governments, you may have a situation in the future where it's used in a draconian way. So there is a genuine concern there around that process of centralization. To Saf's point around the monetary policy, I mean, I think we'd be sort of remiss if we didn't mention monetary policy, because one of the benefits of this is that the Bank of England, through this process of centralization, would have more direct control through interest rates, through those accounts, those CBDC accounts. And one of the things that's often gets mentioned, I mean, helicopter money is one thing, as Saf pointed out, but negative interest rates, yeah, in the academic literature. Although I note the Bank of England doesn't make a big deal about this. And again, I think back to these sort of controversial elements, it is because it's one of those things which sort of crosses the boundary a little bit between what we think of as fiscal policy, you elect politicians to implement, to decide and implement, and central bank policy, which is done independently. because when you think of what is a negative interest rate, effectively it's a bit like a tax on your bank accounts, sort of move you into consumption or riskier assets. But you do, you know, some of the real benefits, if you want to put it that way, are also things which could be quite scary. The programmability of money, which may or may not be a good thing. I think the Bank of England suggesting that the private, you know, these payment institutions, which would be effectively the banks, come up with products that are programmable. So there's an element of consumer
choice.
So
just say a little bit more about what programmable.
Well, I'll defer to Saffel.
Okay, so this will require me to explain a little bit about how this technology works in a bit more detail. So the idea is that you can set rules against any of these digital pounds that determine how you can spend that money or determine where you can spend that money. We touched a little bit on this in the context of sanctions, but essentially there are these things called smart contracts. The idea is that any crypto asset can have rules written into it to govern the use of that crypto asset. Now, sometimes these rules can just, you know, can refer to like trigger payments that meet certain circumstances, certain like deadlines, certain dates, etc. But the often mooted example of this is that if you had a digital pound and you had it linked to that particular technology that would allow for that level of programmability, your middle class parent who sends their kid to university can send them cash that, for example, cannot be spent on alcohol and only be spent on textbooks. Now, whenever programmable money comes up, I think as a mooted suggestion, the Bank of England seems to run 100 miles away in the other direction. They don't really want a piece of this. And actually, specifically, the relationship that they want, because they're fundamentally not set up to do this, is not really to take on any of the sort of customer service capacity that you would normally assume from a private bank that issues cash. So that very much sits with your PIPs, with your ESIPs, and with them governing the relationship between those things. So it's quite interesting, but I suspect most people hearing of the concept of programmable money, I'm speaking only for myself, it does seem like something that you would run 100 miles away from in the other direction.
Well, you can see a live argument on public policy areas, on, for example, criminal justice system. If someone is convicted of being drunk and disorderly or whatever, do you prohibit them from acquiring alcohol?
Welfare recipients. Well,
I was going to say, the next thing is there would be a debate, whether it's a good idea or not, we'll put to one side, but there's certainly be a debate about welfare recipients. Gavin, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I think elaborate on that sort of general point that we've touched on around the Bank of England running away perhaps from the controversial points of this. To some extent, you know, we've perhaps been digging a little bit into the negative sides of this, but what I think in the early phases of design and the proposals the Bank of England put forward, they've tried, I think, to try and either duck some of the tricky issues or to kind of moderate the negative impacts. So if we go back to those points around financial stability and disintermediating the banks, which I think is the big immediate financial market impact, what the Bank of England are proposing is to set a zero interest rate on this. Mm. The better remunerated a CBDC is, the more likely people are to switch into it. So they're suggesting a 0% rate, which would mean that the impact on competition in banking, for instance, would be minimized. The other things they're suggesting, at least initially, are holding limits. So the amount that would be issued and held by an individual, sort of concentrated, is set to a restricted element. So what they're doing there is saying, okay, well, we acknowledge that there are these potential negative impacts. We think there are enough benefits to go ahead with this potentially, but we don't want to, you know, pursue some things which could actually make this very disruptive. And, you know, particularly in the controversial issues of programmability, very original and unconventional monetary policy tools, they're sort of backing away from them a bit. But I think that will leave people with more questions perhaps than answers at this stage. To the extent, okay, well, you know, the financial market disruption might be minimized, but are there certain tools in the future that could come into use which people are actually quite scared about?
Yeah, no, agreed. And I think that at this stage, what the Bank of England is quite keen to do is just set very particular parameters for what these specific requirements are, particularly from like a financial perspective, capital requirements, liquidity requirements, the fact that there needs to be a guaranteed legal claim for each individual against each digital pound, and also backstop protections. So the ability for there to be some kind of deposit guarantee scheme, which can ensure depositors are compensated. That ability to be more involved on sort of critical crisis level control mechanisms is actually quite a positive thing. Guarantees certain protections that consumers just would not have in normal circumstances. And I think the fact that the Bank of England is including that in its design phase, I think suggests a significant amount of forward thinking. But also on the innovation side, there is a bit of a space opened up now, given the consultation, but also just given the extended design phase for private banks to start thinking about products in that context. Whereas I think previously, without the constraints that the Bank of England has put in place, there is the argument that it would have been a complete Wild West.
Let's just conclude looking at next steps. Saf, you already mentioned that we've got a couple of consultations closing in June. What should we be looking out for next?
Well, I think it would be interesting to see what the broad thrust of the result of that consultation is. The current design phase, and certainly the current four-month design consultation phase that involves both Her Majesty's Treasury and the Bank of England, is currently ongoing. So we'll start, I think, to see what the implications will be for asset managers, for potential users, once we're through that. Conceptually, where we are at the moment is very much thinking about this from a design and public policy phase, which I think for our purposes helps us to understand what could happen in the future.
Yep, absolutely. And I think, I'll put myself out there. I think this is almost certainly going to happen, and it's certainly going to happen all over the world. There are a lot of potential problems, which I think will need to be resolved. What we're going to see is a lot of central banks coming out with different positions, which we're starting to see already. These projects get underway. I think we're going to see a lot more engagement from the industry, because as we've said, there are big impacts there for banks, for the investment side, to asset managers, pension funds, insurers, etc. You're thinking about this new risk-free asset. So I think we're going to see a lot more industry engagement in these policy questions that design questions that we've been touching on here. So I think this will certainly gain in prominence, and we'll see more international dialogue. I'm quite sure of that too.
And we're also seeing quite a lot of interest from the government, certainly on the public policy side. There is, a lot of interest in the government pushing the UK and London in particular to become a global crypto hub. Rishi Sunak has always been, certainly as Chancellor, and I think this has carried on into his premiership, with the ambition to make the UK a global hub for crypto asset technology. In a legal context, we've seen that start with the UK Jurisdictional Task Force exploring the settlement and clearing of equity and debt-based securities that are based on crypto technology in the UK. All of this ties into that broad objective. Even more recently, it's been, for anyone following the news on crypto issues generally, Brian Armstrong, CEO of Coinbase, is currently in something of a tangle with the SEC over clarity on how the SEC intends to regulate crypto assets. The UK government seems to be actively courting him at the moment and suggesting that Coinbase could have a home here. So you can see this not just being a policy objective of the Bank of England, but fitting into a narrative that explores the government's broad strategy in relation to crypto and crypto-based assets in general. So I think we're seeing two things happen at once. The mainstreaming of this technology in a way that is more accessible to the user, which I think is broadly, and more accessible to the consumer rather, which I think is broadly positive. And it fitting into the broad policy objectives of the United Kingdom and of the UK government currently, which I think will yield a lot of really interesting results, not just on central bank digital currencies.
Very good. Well, on that note, let's bring this podcast to an end. Let me thank Saf and Gavin, our two gurus, on a topic that I think we will be returning to. I think what struck me in our conversation is this opens up a lot of new issues, policy tools potentially available to the government, but also quite a lot of contentious areas that perhaps haven't yet been fully addressed. So many thanks to both of you. Many thanks to listening to our podcast, and tune in again to the next of our Policy and Practice podcasts. Thank you.